With Professor Orville Shetney of the School of Music on April 12th, 1994. We'll be beginning with your tenure here as a student. I noticed that you are a Wisconsin native. You attended UW-Madison in the years 1934 through 1941, graduating with a Bachelor of Music in Public School Music, that is, a double major in instrumental and vocal music. Would you describe some of your most memorable experiences as an undergraduate?
Well, first of all, my years were 1937 to 41, big deal. Memorable experiences. First of all, I was a poor little old farm boy who finally grew up in Grant County, and I had never been in a big city like Madison. I was thrilled. I thought Madison was wonderful. It had almost 70,000 people. This was big. Streetcars, too. As to memorable experiences, performance in the orchestra, in the chorus, and in the band. And I was in all three. Not every semester, but all three. The orchestra did the whole third act of Die Meistersinger, concert performance. They did an uncut version of St. Matthew Passion in the spring of 41. I was the baritone soloist in that group. They used student soloists, not faculty or professionals. There was a string ensemble formed in the fall of 39, mainly students, but some faculty, and we played principally the Brandenburg Concertos and Semmler Concerto Grosso. I remember evenings when the string orchestra provided the musical entertainment for a reception at the President's house. At that time, the President was Clarence Dykstra. Also, WHA had a studio orchestra and an Saturday afternoon musical performance. It wasn't very far away from what Garrison Keillor is doing these days for Minnesota Public Radio. Big band, assortment of students, performers, some pretty good jazz, comedy acts, and interviews with people on the faculty, some of them serious and some of them deliberately very funny. That was bright stuff. Don Vagely conducted that group, and it was a good performing orchestra. So those at least were some. The opportunity to tour with the band, to go to Big Ten schools, the opportunity to sing in we had a men's chorus at that time, which was on the road and touring. We don't do that anymore. I think organizational performance and opportunity to play repertory I had never dreamed of. Those were the things that sort of stick in the mind. I'm sure there are more.
Okay, sounds like you actually performed in a lot of very famous repertory works.
I was performance crazy at that time. Meanwhile, I earned some money by playing piano in a dance band for about 2-3 years. I was also organist in the local Madison church. And money was tight, and you took every chance you could get.
Uh-huh.
And if you can play a wedding for $5, wonderful. That was nice.
Uh-huh.
That was nice to get. Good money, by the way, at that time.
Yeah.
And
sure.
So on and so forth. So lots of performance.
At that time, your major goals were?
I was enrolled in what was then called public school music, now music education. I was majoring in vocal music education because I was really primarily a singer. And I did study voice for 4 years with the voice teachers here, Earl Swinney, actually. But I did my practice teaching in string methods and also in woodwind performance. So that I had practice teaching experience. In the spring of my senior year, I took over the band program at Edgewood High School. The director there was ill for a time, and I took over the band for about 2 months, and the School of Music accepted that in lieu of practice teaching.
Oh.
So I had band teaching, a little choral teaching, string methods teaching. I taught clarinet for a couple of months, but I don't talk about that because I do not play the clarinet. And of course, voice and vocal work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it sounds like you've got a really well-rounded education here, musically speaking.
I came here with solo experience as a singer. I had been a tuba player in the band and a double bass player in the orchestra. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm sort of a generalist. I have done a little bit of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that a little later when we talk about your tenure here as a faculty mm-hmm. member. I wanted to ask you some things about your undergraduate years here, particularly about the tenure of Carl Bricken as director of the School of Music. Mm-hmm. According to some sources, his tenure brought major changes in the school. Do you recall what some of the circumstances were that brought him to the UW?
Carl Bricken became director of the School of Music, was appointed director of the School of Music, effective the fall of 1938. Charles Mills died very suddenly, late in the summer of 1937. It was much too late to find a replacement. Earl Swinney, then professor of voice, took over the chairmanship of the school on a one-year temporary basis. Swinney was then fairly well up in years, and he said publicly, "I don't want the job, but I'll do it for a year." Mm-hmm. Carl Bricken was appointed by university administration. There was little or no conference with the School of Music faculty that led to the appointment of Bricken. So Bricken was sort of a surprise to the members of the executive committee of that time. That was a tactical error in a political sense, because he had a strike against him when he started. He came from the University of Chicago. He was a native of Kentucky. He was trained as a pianist and a composer. He was a Pulitzer Prize winner. He was a brilliant conductor. He did quite a bit from memory, and he had the ability to bring the orchestra into top-rate performing qualities very quickly. He had a good, and it was a good orchestra. So that by the spring of 39, we knew we had a fireball for a leader, and he did some of the big works, bigger works than I had ever thought of doing at the time. The Meistersingerin was one example, Beethoven Ninth, the St. Matthew Passion, the big C major fantasy of Beethoven, which Beethoven did prior to the Ninth Symphony, and so on and so forth. These are big pieces.
Yes.
We did most of the Sibelius symphonies, because Sibelius was very popular in Madison at that time. Mm-hmm. We had the violin concerto. We had a concerto program featuring members of the Pro Arti Quartet playing concertos for their respective instruments. We had the complete Chopin played in 38, 39 by a pianist of that age called known as Abram Chasins. Chasins was a fine romantic pianist, on the romantic side, sure, but a magnificent technician, and that was a series of 12 recitals which gave us a complete Chopin.
So he was in residence here?
He came in for recitals once every 2 weeks, yeah.
Oh, he did? And
Bricken brought him in. Bricken also brought the Pro Arti Quartet. Mm-hmm. He brought Gunnar Johansson, who doesn't need any explanation here.
Mm-hmm.
He brought Hilmar Lockhart, who became the best theorist we had. Hilmar came from Chicago in the rank of instructor. He was a young man, unmarried, just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
So I had counterpoint, species counterpoint with Lockhart.
Mm-hmm.
And also with Bricken. Bricken taught species counterpoint.
I see. So while Bricken was actual director of the school, he also participated in a lot of the actual musical.
He was conductor of the university orchestra. He taught at least one, usually two, theory courses.
I see, per semester.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of work.
He had a teaching load half again what we'd ever experienced today.
Yes, that's really a lot. Okay, at this point
I should add too.
Oh.
Fine musician. One of the most spectacular things I ever witnessed came in my senior graduation time. That would have been late May of 1941. Bricken had a party out at his house for all the graduating seniors. and some of the faculty. Johansson was there. Somebody started to talk about improvisation, and Bricken said, let's improvise. He had two grand pianos in his living room. Gunnar took one, and he took the other. And they said, what do you want to improvise on? And somebody said, try Brahms Fourth. So the big Passacaglia theme, the F minor theme, was their theme. They played the theme, and the two of them improvised a four-hand statement of the Brahms. And there was no fake about that, because we told them what to play.
Yes.
And it was a magnificent performance. Now, this was a kind of raw talent that I hadn't seen very often.
Mm-hmm.
And Gunnar, of course, fully equal to it. There's no flies on Gunnar when it comes to playing the piano.
Well, that must have been pretty inspirational.
It was an absolute thrill.
How do you think that his innovations, that is, those of Carl Bricken, influenced the school as a whole?
In the long view, Bricken turned the school away from music education and in favor of much more emphasis on performance. Now, that needs to be understood in context.
Good.
Because the School of Music, such as it was, even before Mills's time, had been something of a leader in music education. The School of Music, and I checked this the other day, when was the host in 1884 to the National Education Association, which met here in Madison. The secretary of the NEA at that time was a Madison native named T.H. Brand. Before World War I, music education came to the fore around here. Early faculty, about 1920, included Norval Church and Peter Dykema, both of whom went on to Columbia University and to national prominence as leaders in music education. We were hosts in the 1920s to national music tournaments, band tournaments, so that there was a good deal of emphasis in the music education sector at that time. E.B. Gordon, whose name is well known, was one of the leaders on that. Gordon had had some experience in Chicago, music education oriented, and Morphy, same way. Interestingly enough, Major Morphy and E.B. Gordon were both trained as violinists. We forget that, but that was their own instrument.
Mm-hmm. I think that's important.
So we had emphasis on music education. Bricken turned that around in favor of performance by bringing in people whom I just mentioned, Johansson mm-hmm. and the Priority amongst them. Unfortunately, he was not as adroit politically as he was when he was writing Counterpoint. And he succeeded in making the whole music education community in the state fairly uncomfortable. I think it's not going too far to say that the music education community was pretty well peeved at Bricken by 1940, because he was downplaying the importance of music ed in favor of performance.
Just by his actions.
And by his attitudes, he didn't have the patience with the music ed community, who somehow he didn't regard with the kind of respect that he would have paid to some of the artist performers that he had. Not only violinists, but instrumentalists as well. We had Alfred Bartel from the Chicago Orchestra teaching oboe, for instance, came up here to do it. Well, this sort of thing built the performance image of the School of Music. So that by 1940, we were known here as a center of performance in orchestra, in band certainly. Ray Dvorak was in his good years at that time, and also in piano, and to a somewhat lesser extent in voice. Those were stellar. We had chamber music going. Leon Eltus was a fine pianist in chamber music, so was Lockwood Carpenter. These people toured all over the place. Cecil Burley was on the road doing violin recitals, and Leon Eltus was his pianist.
Mm-hmm. Was Burley at that time very famous for a number of his compositions?
His compositions, yes. Burley was a composer.
Mm-hmm.
In the Impressionist style, his works do have a Debussy ring to them. amongst the students, we thought he was a bit behind the times in 1940. Impressionism in Europe was dead, as we all know. Nonetheless, Berlioz did three violin concertos and three symphonies, and that's a lot. And he toured all over the place as a violinist, with playing violin recitals or in string trios. So in his good years, he was a fine performer. He came from Morningside College out in Sioux City, Iowa. Louise Lockwood Carpenter was in the picture at that time, and Bricken got along well with her. Louise Lockwood was her maiden name, her professional name. She had a degree from Yale, pianist, expert in chamber music, not so much as a pianist for singers, but her forte was piano for small ensembles, especially string ensembles, and she was an artist to her toes and played very, very well. In Madison, she married a man named Russell Carpenter, and so I knew her as Mrs. Russell Carpenter. Her professional name was Louise Lockwood.
Okay, so at this point, you're describing the context of music education and Bricken creating a sort of rift, is that correct, between music education and music performance?
Well, it wasn't sort of. It was a pretty deep rift, I'm afraid.
It was.
Yeah.
And how long-lasting was that? Does that affect the school of music to this day?
I think to this day we're still suffering from it. After Bricken's departure in 1944, Leon Iltis became the chairman, and Iltis was somewhat oriented in his own beliefs and philosophies in favor of music education, and he tried to make good contacts with the music ed people and to build up that side of things and to smooth over the rift. Remember Sam Burns, who was brought here about 49. Was himself a music education person. So he tried, and over the years we have mended our fences, I think, with the music ed community. But the older people in the music ed community, as late as 1950s and 60s, were still very suspicious of Madison and strangely loyal to what was then called Milwaukee State Teachers College, which had a prominence in music education traditionally. In those days, the state colleges had their emphases, and music was one of the emphases over in Milwaukee. Now, of course, the UWM.
I see.
So it's been a tough fight all of those years to reestablish the image and the prominence of music education, and that has not happened here, I think, until relatively recent years.
Within the past, what period of
time? Oh, 60s, 70s, I think it's 80s.
Okay.
We've had people who tried, who did their best, but it takes a long time to shape public opinion on a statewide basis. That doesn't happen quickly.
I'm sure. You mentioned that Carl Bricken actually had a course load, and I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how he was viewed as an instructor.
Well, he taught counterpoint. I took counterpoint from him. He had immense skill at the blackboard, at the chalkboard. He could stand up there and write counterpoint as fast as the chalk would go. And it was wonderful to watch this musical mind work. I think he was impatient with people who weren't so gifted. I enjoyed it. My own feeling for him is good, but that is not a universally held opinion. I think some of our people thought he was too tough. Some of them thought he was too spotty. He didn't have much of a syllabus. He was sort of disorganized as a teacher sometimes, and there were problems.
I see. So it sounds like this was sort of a way he was living out his feeling that pedagogical techniques were not that important.
No. He came out of the old school. He came out of the old conservatory approach, and I have wondered if maybe a state university climate was the right climate for him. He may have been better off in a smaller more prestigious, more high-powered liberal arts institution where there was a high degree of emphasis on culture and a lesser degree on some of the mass production techniques that big campuses always do.
Yeah, of course, yes. Well, do you have any opinions about why he remained at the UW for 6 years, 6 years only?
Well, you have to put that in the context of history. World War II started for the U.S. in 41, as we all know.
Mm-hmm.
By 1943, the campus was decimated. In 1940 or so, the ratio of men to women in the undergraduate population was about 2 to 1.
Mm.
By 44, that ratio, I think, had done a flip-flop. There were more women than men. Most of the men were in military service. And the men students we had were, for one thing, those who were deferred for a variety of military reasons. You couldn't tour a group in 44. We didn't have the men to do it. We didn't have the gasoline to do it. We didn't have the money to do it. And there were war-related problems that tended to squash down the performance opportunities. So he became somewhat disillusioned, I think, during those years.
I see.
I don't have direct memories because I myself was in military service those years. But I think he burned himself out here trying to make a success in a situation in which real success simply wasn't possible, partly for political reasons, because the music head people didn't like him, and partly for university reasons, because the deans and the administrators of the university at that time were not especially pro-music. It was hard to get a nickel out of the dean for anything.
I see.
He had political problems, many chairmen did, with the university administration of that time, and he was... I think he just sort of got disillusioned and burned out of it. His last years were not pleasant. Some people say he had a drinking problem. I don't have direct news about that, but it's been said. On the other hand, he left here in 1944 to go to Seattle to become conductor of the Seattle Orchestra. He followed Sir Thomas Beecham as director of the Seattle.
Mm.
Now, you don't do that unless you know what you're doing. That alone is tribute to what the man had to offer. I talked to him in May of 44. I then had overseas orders and did in 2 weeks go to the Philippines, go to the South Pacific. And he said to me a strange thing. He says, when you get out of service, I hope you go to music education. He says, because we may not all like it, but that's where the needs are in the Middle West, and that's going to be where the jobs are when this damned war, can I say that, is over with. And that told me that in spite of the fact he'd stubbed his toe with the music head people, he realized down deep that music education in this school was very, very important, and he in point blank urged me to go towards it. I think this is a sort of an answer to some of the criticisms the man has had to suffer, some of which, frankly, are unfair. He was not that bad.
Could you clarify what you perceived him to mean by needs, where the needs are?
Good teachers, teachers who know how to go into a school system and make music.
Okay, so he was...
And music education at that point was beginning to attract some mediocrity because the goodies, the good people, were going into performance. And he saw that as an undesirable trend. And I agree with him. I think
Absolutely.
He's right on that. We,
yes.
If there's any place in this world we need talent, it's at the high school level because that's where you inspire kids. And if we don't get on that stick, we won't have a good teaching community in 25 years. I feel very strongly about this issue, but it's interesting to me that Bricken, who has been condemned and pilloried for his attitude towards music education, would in fact make such a speech to me in the spring of 44, within weeks of his departure. His resignation was already in, and it was, as it turned out, 3 weeks before I was sent overseas. I was in service at the time, warrant officer, band leader.
Okay. I'd like to switch topics now. We've been talking about Carl Bricken, but now I'd like to switch over to the Haresfoot Club Band. A little more lighthearted topic here.
Whatever else Haresfoot is, it's lighthearted.
You mentioned that you played in the Haresfoot Club Band for 4 years, and I'd like, if possible, for you to describe some experiences with that. For instance, what kind of music was played?
Well, in the first place, Haresfoot was a social club. They are one of the ancestors of humorology, though those two are not really comparable. But they had an elected president and a vice president and were registered as a social organization. They had a budget. They had an office over in the student union building. They wrote and produced shows. At that time, they had a script writer who wrote the text, the librettist, if you will, and a composer, or sometimes more than one composer, who wrote the music for the shows they did. Now, the music was in big band style, Ella 1935 to 40. This was big band jazz. The shows were written in the summer and in the fall, cast in the late fall, rehearsed in the winter time. Somebody had to write orchestrations, remember. Somebody had to score it. And then the shows were given during spring vacation when the whole troupe went on tour by train. We traveled by railroad coach at that time, of course, Pullmans with a club car. And we toured around the state of Wisconsin on a tour and returned for the triumphal be-all performance in the Union Theater, usually, on the Saturday night. That would have been the last Saturday of spring vacation. And then we all stumbled back to class on Monday morning.
That must have been really the peak experience.
This was Joe College hijinks. Haresfoot was for men only. No women were used. They had a chorus line. Two of the four shows I played used a chorus line that, amongst other things, danced the French can-can, which is noisy and big. Now, you have to remember that the football team was recruited for the chorus line.
Almost
so several, several, I should think most of the chorus line dancers were, in fact, out of Harry Stuhldreher's football team. Stuhldreher was coach, and he was a big name at that point. You know? Well, these guys were 6 feet something, and they weighed 200 pounds and something, and they wore high-heeled shoes, size 14 to 18, and they had to shave their hairy legs and so on and so on. It was funny as all get-out. It was not vulgar, and it was not erotic. But the idea of men dressing as women and spoofing a musical comedy had an audience appeal at that time that was unmistakable. They had a loose little story. The stories, like stories in all musical comedies, weren't much. But then again, look at the stories in some of the musical comedies we've had since. You know, you can't get all shook up by the libretto in shows like, well, any of the big Broadway musicals of today. Even Miss Saigon would be mentioned on that. Pit orchestra, which included a sax section, a brass section, bass, piano, and guitar. I played bass for a while. I played piano on one show, and I played cello for one tour. I was a cello was my second string instrument. I was playing double bass in the orchestra. Conductors came from the band. One year, the conductor was the band TA. Another year, a senior in music education named Earl Boyd took the conductor's job. Earl finished his career in Illinois, professor of music ed, by the way, clarinet player.
Did
so
the band?
Big band in the pit, a silly little plot. Always with a romantic story, which was burlesque, so it got to be, let's say, funny. I think the word gross kind of covers it. There was always a heavy, and always somebody very dumb, a stereotype dummy mm-hmm. who played it for laughs, don't mm-hmm. you see? And then this chorus line. Mm-hmm. Show was in two acts and take about 2 hours. We traveled by train. There were sets. There was the theater sets. Cities we toured in would have been the larger cities in Wisconsin as of that time. And I remember, for instance, Baraboo, shows in Baraboo, in Eau Claire, in Wausau, Green Bay, I'm sure, La Crosse, in Milwaukee on Friday night, and in Madison on Saturday night. Oshkosh, not every year, but frequently. We always started in Baraboo, and that would have been in the Ringling Theater in Baraboo, oh. which still exists as a historic landmark. And one of my pleasures was to play the organ. There's a good theater organ up there at that point, so I played 15 minutes worth of theater music on the organ, playing the tunes that were in Harriswood, don't you see?
Uh-huh.
And then the orchestra came in, took their places in the pit, and played the overture, which was a potpourri medley of these tunes. Sentimental ballads, World War II style, Moon, June, Spoon kind of thing. They were dumb and silly, but they were funny.
Uh-huh.
And they were trips, the performances were sponsored by local alumni clubs.
Oh.
We had to go to a city where there was a fairly active UW alumni club. And I suspect that there was a little fundraising going on at the same time. Alumni office would send a representative, you know, and keep the fences mended with the folks back home.
I see.
That's nothing less than good politics and entirely good a good procedure for a university.
Uh-huh.
In that sense, I think Harriswood did this campus a lot of good because it was immensely popular. These things were sellout shows. I mean, sold
throughout
out.
Throughout the state?
Absolutely.
You don't typically think
you didn't get a ticket
this
2 weeks after before the show.
Oh, really?
No.
You just don't typically think of this thing being so popular with people in the outlying areas in Wisconsin.
Well, vaudeville was still around at that point, and these shows were close to classic vaudeville.
Yeah, I see. So, do you remember who was in the audience in the surrounding areas then, for the most part? Were they mostly alumni, or were there also other people who maybe never attended college?
We had no way of judging that. I mean, you sit in the pit orchestra and play for these people out here, you don't mm-hmm. know who they are. Surely, there was a high proportion of alumni of the university, because the tickets were pushed through university resources. Surely there would have been a fairly substantial proportion of local people who were prominent in the local communities.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, tickets were sold in a box office, and anybody who wanted them could buy them if you got there soon enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How were you received in the various cities? Can you distinguish between how you received in Milwaukee versus Baraboo versus Wausau, for instance?
Generally good, except the Milwaukee was the tough one.
Really?
Because, Milwaukee is a big city, and it had mm-hmm. a whole lot going on. So if you took a show into Milwaukee, there was quite a bit of competition from other worthy events that were there at the same time. That's less true in the more outlying cities in the state.
I see. How about the final production, then, once
Here
you got
Madison,
back to Madison?
The final production was done in the Parkway Theater downtown. Parkway is next to what is now 30 on the Square, on the north side of the Square. Parkway was a theater, a vaudeville theater, with a pretty good stage on it. It was an old theater, but that was sort of what we called an Opry house.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, the Union Theater was built and dedicated in 1939, so after that the performances were in the new Union Theater, which of course we still have today.
Mm-hmm. And so the audience, how were they compared to here in Madison, compared to the ones in the outlying areas?
Well, I think we had more students and fewer townspeople, because the member of the Infraternity Council, the IF, was big stuff and very powerful at that point. The whole fraternity sorority movement, probably three times as big as it is now. Mm-hmm. And socially powerful. And the fraternities and sororities would buy blocks of tickets and send their members. I think. And if one of their people had a lead role in the Hairsfoot show, the Daily Cardinal would tell us about it day after day after day. This was part of the prestige of the house. And some of our Hairsfoot performers were themselves officers in the fraternities.
So it was not only socially acceptable to be a member and an active participant in Hairsfoot, but it was really something that was sought after.
The word socially acceptable is too weak.
I see.
It was socially desirable.
I see.
And if you didn't make it in your fraternity house, that was kind of a social blow that you had to somehow.
Oh, really?
Sure. Just like the women weren't involved because this was a men's operation.
Sure.
But the same thing would happen, of course, to the girls who would come here, go through sorority rush, and then not get picked. That's a disaster. That hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there was a matter of social prestige of beings that were selected into the better houses, and everybody knew who the better houses were. This was a pecking order kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
It was very sensitive. Langdon Street was a busy and high-powered place.
Mm-hmm.
I can talk more about that too, but let's for the moment go ahead.
Okay. So did the club membership predominantly consist of any kind of students, such as theater or music majors?
Not many music majors, except in the orchestra.
I see.
Theater majors, yeah. I can think of two names who started in Hairsfoot who ended up in the theater. One was a man named Willard Schultz. Schultz went into theater work and made a career in drama. The other was a student named Seymour Horowitz, who wrote one of the librettos for the show. The show of 39 or 40, I'd have to look on that. After graduation, he was a theater major. After graduation, he changed his name to Cy Howard, went to Hollywood, and had a 20-year career as a producer of Hollywood motion pictures. You know, he got his start here.
Hmm.
So did some other people, like Fred Gerber, who ended up as director of the state radio station in Bloomington, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
These were theater majors, good ones.
Well, I wondered about the librettos. I know that, you know, they were very light, puffy, you know.
Frothy.
Yeah, frothy sorts of. But I wondered if they also reflected issues of the times, and if so, in what ways?
Oh, that's a good question, because one of the shows did. One of the shows had to do with a spoof on the Hitler dictatorship.
Oh, do you remember what year that was?
Let's see, what year was that? I'm going to say 1940.
Hmm.
It's not as early as 39, and I don't think it was 41, but it's 1940. It had something to do with the dictator. And so the lead characters were faking a terrible German accent and
uh-huh.
pulling all kinds of jokes on the dictator, you see, who was, of course,
mm-hmm.
Hitler. I think Cy Horowitz, who was Jewish himself,
mm-hmm.
Would have had something to do with that, because at this point it was clear that the anti-Semitism of the German government
mm-hmm.
was already an international disgrace.
Yes.
And so in Hairsfoot they played it for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
Very well, by the way. It was funny. Big mm-hmm. show and successful.
It was successful,
oh,
even
yeah.
in this predominantly
oh, sure.
German
oh, sure.
state.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So that, I think, really grew out of some of the major events of the time. The time, of course, was the immediate pre-war years.
Sure. But there were no serious discussions then after, or spawned by that, for instance, in the Daily Cardinal or anything, in reviews
of it. They
played
it for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
This was good cakes.
Uh-huh. This was a humorous outlet.
I'm sure, you know, people are capable of being serious, but they weren't serious in connection with the show itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The great vaudevilles productions of the time were not serious
mm-hmm.
in that sense.
Do you think that Hairsfoot reflected current issues more than regular vaudeville and the vaudeville tradition?
No, not necessarily. That one show did, but this was not a spoof on times, on the times we live in. That was not its intention.
I see.
And the plots were, you know, the plots were, like many theater plots, were really not very good as stories. It was simply a framework of something to hang on, some dancing and some comedy routine and a few little vocal soloists and a couple of band numbers and something that was a relaxed sort of potpourri that people could sit and listen to and look at and laugh at.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the late 1930s, we needed a laugh. That
I'm
was
sure.
important to the audience. We'd had it with the Depression of 1929 to 35 or 36 or 37.
Mm-hmm.
And by the middle 30s, we were really worried about all this stuff going on over in England and Germany. And big names of the time included people like the Prime Minister of England, Chamberlain, for instance, and the whole Hitler establishment and the excesses of Hermann Göring and the others who were involved. We all know our World War II history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think that the Haresfoot Club made any significant contributions to the university as a whole?
Well, not beyond what I've already said. It was a powerful and successful social activity. It was a social club.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of what we might call college hijinks.
Mm-hmm.
In the time when the students had a lot of fun, did a lot of kidding, but were not disruptive, who were not negative in their approach towards the the university, as they were in the 1960s, in the time of upset.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't challenge authority in the 1930s, like many students will challenge authority now.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, is what makes the older people a little nervous at some of the student activities we've perceived here in the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole different topic. But
yeah.
you just didn't address faculty or issues or the campus or university policy in negative and destructive terms. There was something in this world called respect,
mm-hmm.
and we had it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. During the 1950s, that is really when you were here as faculty member, the shows were Broadway musicals. Originally.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, formerly they had been original creations of UW students.
Yeah.
Do you have any opinion about the cause and effect of this change?
Well, as to cause, I think it got to be increasingly difficult to find students who were undergraduates who were able to write the script and to write the popular songs that could be played in the jazz idiom of the 50s, which, remember, was a lot different than the jazz idiom of the late 30s. Big bands were bigger, and performance standards were high, and so it got to be difficult to find people who had the technical competence they needed to write these shows. That's one side of it. I think the club was already in a state of decline. I think it peaked just before the war, and never really rebounded after World War II to the popularity that it had in the 1920s and 30s.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the demographics of the student population after the Second World War might have influenced that at all?
I don't think there's any question about that, because the average age of the students in 1940 would have been a college age, 1920-21, whereas the average age of the students in the middle 40s, with the GI, what we call the GI bulge, thousands of veterans coming out of service, the average age was suddenly up to 25 or 26. High proportion of them were married, they had kids, and they were somehow beyond the stylistic level of the hijinks that had made Haresfoot so exceptional. This was no longer attractive, it seems to me, to large numbers of students. I came out of service in the spring, in the winter of 46, and enrolled that spring semester here. Half of the men on campus were still wearing military uniforms, because it's all we had to wear. You couldn't buy a suit. And clothing shortages and whatnot, and I was 26. Many of my classmates were that age, and it was a different kind of climate. In the 50s, we did have the Korean War to deal with, which put a blanket on a lot of social activities. And of course, by the 60s, the whole thing was dead.
Yes.
60s to me are a bad decade. I wish I could forget.
Do you?
Yeah.
In terms of the music school, even?
In terms of the whole of the American society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was a decade that we're not going to be very proud of as the years go on.
Mm-hmm. Wanted to just go back to one final thing about the Haresfoot Club. You mentioned powerful people in the community who were linked with the Haresfoot. Mm-hmm. Bill Purnell, Leo Kale, Ray Hilsenhoff. Do you think that the productions would have been different had there not been financial and managerial support from the town?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Because the club had an elected president who was an undergraduate, remember. And the officers of the club had to have professional help to do some of these things. We had to have a choreographer, you mm-hmm. see, and we had to have a business manager who knew how to handle relatively large sums of money. These things were not low-budget operations. And so they went to people who were able to do it. Bill Purnell ran an exclusive men's clothing store, one of the elegant shops on State Street at the time. Leo Kale had a dance studio in town, and his daughters, I might add, are still active as dance teachers in Madison. The Kale studio still goes on. Leo was an old vaudeville man, good choreographer, good tap dancer. He knew how to put on, how to make good theater. And that's what it was. It was mm-hmm. basically good theater, good mm-hmm. vaudeville theater. Good teacher. In his good years, Leo would have been, I suppose, in his 40s at that time, but an active man with a whole lot of energy. Mm-hmm. And he rehearsed that dance troupe every night of the week, and he could dance right along with the rest of them, who were 21 or 22, remember.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Mr. Hilsenhoff was, I don't know what his job was, but he was in the bursar's office and an accountant by training. So these
three... ...with Professor Orval Shetney, Marianne Long, interviewing. You mentioned impressions of Charles Mills, Ray Dvorak, and Irene Eastman. Could you describe for me these people through your particular vantage point as an undergraduate?
Well, in order, Charles Mills was director of the School of Music from 1914 to 1937. And I may be one of the few people around here who actually saw Charles Mills. I was in the music clinic in the summer of 1937. The clinic at that time was given a banquet over in Great Hall of the Union, and the clinic faculty was there, but Mills was host of that, and so I heard him speak, and I suppose you could say I met him because he came around to talk to as many people as possible. Mills was English. He was an FAGO, Fellow in the American Guild of Organists, mm-hmm. and that's the mm-hmm. highest rank you can attain in the organ world. Pianist, of course. He'd come here in 1914 from the University of Illinois. He was not a terribly tall man.
Mm-hmm. That's
he was a bit on the portly side. Had a walrus mustache, pictures of him are around. Pince-nez glasses they would pick on there, and that made it possible for him to raise his eyebrows, and that would drop the glasses down on the gold chain. Well, this is 19th century elegance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have as handy his birth dates, but he would have been back in the 1800s, surely. Genial, able, apparently a humorous man, and by any measure, well, the measure I'm using is that his name continued to be immensely popular with the faculty of the post-30s and 40s that I knew. They all knew Mills, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Mills's widow lived in Madison for a long time. She outlived him by many years. He died of a heart attack very suddenly, and he was in his 60s at the time. But Mills really built this department. During the Mills administration, we had the first Bachelor of Music degree, 1921.
Mm-hmm.
The first Master of Music degree, 1928. And the first PhD in music, 1936. Mills died in 37.
Mm-hmm.
Leland Kuhn was chairman of that committee. Mills was director, not chairman, and his tenure was not subject to review. And somehow he managed to keep the school on an even keel. He certainly built the curriculum. Mills was good on curriculum.
Yeah.
He built the catalog, the bulletin of the School of Music, into something that looked fairly impressive,
mm-hmm.
And oversaw a lot of the growth of the school. He brought R. Andelli here in 1928 and 29 to found the music clinic, so that this university was the first state university in the U.S. to have a summer music clinic for high school students. And that's partly Mills' work, because Mills was director at the time. And without his support, it wouldn't have happened, don't you see?
Did he have a vision of what a summer music clinic would be?
I don't know, but he must have had, because he went to Joe Matty over in Michigan saying, "You've got a clinic going, we want to do it too. Who do you suggest?" And the suggestion was a man named Orion Dally, Dalley, who was hired in the late 20s to be orchestra director. That was his job.
I see.
And also to start the summer music clinic. And that's
mm-hmm.
why the music clinic of 1929 is the first of the high school music clinics. I came to it in the summer of 1937, which was the eighth music clinic, and we had at that point about 550 high school students enrolled that summer.
Mm-hmm.
They were housed over in Shadburn Hall mainly, which mm-hmm. was next to the School of Music and convenient. So that Mills made a lot of contributions, new degrees, a general raising of image. He had his faculty out touring, Iltis, Kuhn, Lockwood Carpenter, and Earl Swinney were on the road doing performance recitals. Swinney took the university chorus to Chicago, to the Orchestra Hall in Chicago in the middle of 1920s, 2-3 times. So Wisconsin ensembles were performing out of state. And that wouldn't have happened without Mills's push, don't you see?
Mm-hmm.
So he did quite a bit. Ray Dvorak came here in 1934 as band director. Major Morphy, again, had died suddenly, and we had no band director. Mills, who had come here from the University of Illinois in 1914, went back to Urbana saying, "We need a band director. Who do you recommend?" One thing led to another, and we got Ray Dvorak, who was at that point a TA in the University of Illinois band establishment. That's how he came up here.
Huh.
Ray really built the marching band. Morphy was a good conductor, trained as a violinist and a good musician. He had good, solid classical training behind him. But with all respect, Morphy was not the showman that Dvorak was.
Showman. Can you talk a little more about that?
The university band's supposed to put on a show at the football games.
Mm-hmm.
So Ray built the image of the university band at all of the games. He trained the band to do formations on the field, to spell out the word Wisconsin, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
He marched way over 200 people. My memory is 240 in the band at that point. That's not big enough, so you can do a lot with them.
Mm-hmm.
And by the middle 30s, the University of Wisconsin band was well known and highly regarded, especially for its field work.
Mm-hmm.
Dvorak was a leader in the use of radio for School of Music events. That goes back to Mills, too, who oversaw the first broadcast by School of Music students over radio station WHA in 1921. Now that's early on in the radio business.
Did they just perform a concert?
Concert, sure, mm-hmm. and it was broadcast.
Mm-hmm. A one-time thing?
Yeah.
Or?
And Pop Gordon had founded a program called Journeys in Music Land. There's all kinds of information about Journeys in Music Land, but that dates from 1924. Again, Mills was in his good years, and it wouldn't have happened without Mills' support.
Mm-hmm.
And Mills and Gordon, obviously, were good friends and got along, you know. so that and Dvorak picked up the broadcasting thing during the fall seasons, well, all year. When I was in the band, 1937, 8, 9, and 40, the band used to do a half-hour broadcast. This was Dvorak's idea. Every Thursday afternoon. The rehearsals were Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Thursday was broadcast day. We'd start rehearsing at 3:30, work for about a half an hour, knock something into shape, have a radio outlet in Music Hall with lines over to Old Radio Hall, which was on the other side of the campus, that still stands. And the band would play a march or two and one serious composition, and then a representative of the Alumni Association, for a long time, a man named Fred Berge, B-E-R-G-E, would do a short address over the air, and it was promotional in nature, what's going on the campus, who did what, who got their name in the paper, and then the band had winded up with that. And Ray did that during football season. So then we had Friday to get something in shape for the game on Saturday. How he did all that, I don't know, but he did.
That must have been a real thrill to be able to be on radio.
We were on the radio every week.
Yeah, that must have had some sort of impact on all of the students who played in the band then.
It gave direct radio experience to everybody who was in the concert band. We had three bands, concert band, first regimental, and second regimental, and those were training bands for the ROTC people.
Oh, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Which was big at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, radio was hot stuff, mm-hmm. important. Mm-hmm. And if you got on the radio, you generally said so on your resume.
I bet.
We don't do that these days, but we did then. Let's see. I can go on about that, but looking at the situation, maybe I could say a word about Irene Eastman.
Okay.
Irene Eastman came to the campus in 1910. She had a bachelor's degree from the New England Conservatory. I had been told that Parker was one of her teachers. I'm not sure about that.
I see.
By the way, I am sure that Mills' major professor in England was Ebenezer Prout. He was a Prout student.
Mm-hmm.
Eastman came out of New England Conservatory at that time, one of the handful of good conservatories in the U.S., so that she mm-hmm. was well prepared and with a rather prestigious kind of resume when she came. She came to teach theory and organ. Mills was an organist, but he needed help. And the organ in Music Hall was old at that time and was replaced again due to Mills. Mills funded the new organ. In 1929, a four-manual Mohler with about 60 ranks of pipes on it in Old Music Hall.
Mm.
That was Mills' organ, and mm-hmm. Irene taught on it. Irene taught music theory, typically sophomore theory, now and then music history. I took one course in music history from Irene. She was a short lady. She was what we might call a classy lady, too.
Classy.
Classy. She was meticulous in her dress,
ah.
a bit old-fashioned in her style of clothing,
mm-hmm.
but meticulously perfect in its own time. Little beads, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She again wore pince-nez glasses. They were very popular at that time. As the years went on, she got a little bit heavy, though she was never had a real weight problem. What she could do was to stand in front of a freshman class and straighten herself up as tall as possible so that her 5'2" height looked overwhelming.
Uh-huh.
And bare at you with those black eyes and make you feel like 2 cents. She could be, not often, but could be a real tyrant in class. If you came mm-hmm. in unprepared, or if you did something stupid at the blackboard when you were writing harmony, I used to wince a little when she walked over to me and started to let me have it, which she did sometimes. Good teacher, mm-hmm. a good musician, and a power. She retired in 1954, I believe. That would have given her 44 years on this faculty. Mm-hmm. I don't know why she was never promoted to associate professor. She retired as an assistant professor.
Because you feel she was very competent?
No question about her competence. No question at all. She was a fine musician, fine teacher, good improviser.
Oh.
And in her good years, pretty good technician on the organ. But she was a leader in SAI at that time, Sigma Alpha Iota. She and a colleague, Helene Stratman Thomas, who late in life became Mrs. Blotz, remember, Helene married in her senior years. Those two dominated the scene. They were, Irene was known or referred to, sort of, as the Dean of Women of the School of Music. Now, she was no dean, but the point is she functioned as a student friend. She was what we now would call an ombudsman for the women students. And if one of the women students had some sort of a problem, why, they had an immediate friend in Irene Eastman.
Do you remember any particular issues that she helped with that were common knowledge among the other students?
No, except that she was an advocate for the women student body. And a powerful support for SAI, which at that point was a strong organization on the campus.
In terms of?
Well, SAI is a professional. They call themselves Fraternity for Women, founded in 1903, and the chapter, of course, is still active here in Madison. Do you want to go into that?
No, that's fine. I think we can wrap up here with a final question about any links that you might recall between the WPA and the School of Music, if there were many.
I can't help you much on that. The WPA, Works Progress Administration, was one of the recovery measures instituted by Franklin Roosevelt. The WPA group in Madison worked in what is now the, what was then the orchestra office. That's on the bottom floor of Music Hall back in the southwest corner. It's directly underneath what was then the office of the director, the principal director. They were music copyists. They copied manuscripts. They sorted and collected some of the music we had. A lot of it was in manuscript form, remember. But I don't know what the connection was with the School of Music. That would have been federal money brought in, frankly, to help musicians. They would have been principally performers, some of them up in years, some of them beyond the point of being able to make their own livings and they're in their craft. So there was a social dimension to it. I know that one of the men, and I wish I knew his name, had been a leading tenor in the Berlin Staatsoper, came to Madison, again for war-related reasons, and worked in that WPA office as a copyist for a time. He would have then been in his 60s, I would think. The WPA people were not young people.
I wonder how long he was there.
I don't know.
That's fascinating.
I don't know. That's a fascinating story. But, you know, they just were given office space, and they did certain jobs, and we all knew they were WPA people, but we didn't know, and I guess we probably didn't care very much either what they were actually doing. It was not part of the School of Music operation itself.
Okay. Well, thank you for your informative, articulate, and very colorful interview, and I hope in the near future we can have one more interview about your tenure at UW as a faculty member from 1956 through the present. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Enjoy it.